the following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London.
Good night and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight with Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Sit right down and you'll hear a tale of patriarchy. As many states are going back to the 19th century, it's primitive as can be. They tout the sanctity of life, but their actions have clearly shown. Once babies are outside our wombs, they're totally on their own. Screw 'em, they're on their own. Not rape, incest, or the mother's health, no exceptions may be filed. And so they'll make an 11-year-old carry her rapist's child. No wonder these laws are reviled. It seems in states which pulled this crap, there also happens to be the highest rates of maternal and infant death, and also teen pregnancy.
I guess abstinence-only education doesn't work. Like, duh.
Men saying things like consensual rape sure proves they don't respect me. If they're so concerned, let's make men get a mandatory vasectomy.
And while we're at it, let's make it a natural vasectomy.
We have to act now and curtail this flagrant rights restriction in Alabama, Georgia, and Kentucky, Mississippi, Missouri, Utah, Ohio, and more. We cannot fail to make sure The Handmaid's Tale stays a work of fiction.
Lauren Mayer, everyone. That is Lauren Mayer with The Handmaid's Tale. It took me a few listens to realize that that was done to the tune of the theme song to Gilligan's Island. I know I'm dating myself, but I'm old. What can I tell you? Yes, a dark but truthful twist on the Gilligan's Island theme. For those who are asking about the whole Handmaid's Tale thing, Handmaid's Tale was a book by Margaret Atwood that I honestly never read. I watched the first season on Hulu. It's a Hulu original program, and very well done. But that it's dark and it's disturbing, and there's so many parallels with what's going on now in real life. But anyway, I digress. Welcome to the show. It is a Wednesday. It is a busy day. The highlight of the day so far was Robert Mueller surprising us all by going before the cameras and the microphones, no questions though, to make a statement on the Mueller report. Here's a little bit of what, well, here's the main point that you need to take away.
If we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so.
If we had confidence that the president did not commit a crime, we would have said so. Period. End of fucking statement. So we'll talk more about this. But to help us navigate our way through, let's get Greg Sargent on the line. Now, you know Greg Sargent. Hopefully you read the Plumline blog at the Washington Post every day. And hopefully you've also read his book, because Greg Sargent, well, again, is the man behind the Plumline blog at the Washington Post. His Twitter handle is TheplumlineGS. He's also the author of An Uncivil War, Taking Back Our Democracy in an Age of Trumpian Disinformation and Thunderdome Politics. And boy, we are seeing Trumpian disinformation right now. So I'm thrilled to welcome Greg Sargent back to the show. Hey, Greg, how you doing?
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for being here. I know you watched, as I did, as the rest of us did, Robert Mueller go before the cameras today to make a statement on the Mueller report. It's pretty amazing to realize that this is the first time I'd ever heard him speak. I didn't know what his voice would sound like. And now I sort of understand why he doesn't do it very often.
Well, you know, it is interesting. I found myself surprised by the sound of his voice, too. And it is pretty remarkable how silent he's been throughout this whole process. I'm pretty sure that only one statement was released, maybe in response to that BuzzFeed story about... Right?
Yeah.
And so hearing from him, I think, was still highly significant. There's been some debate on Twitter about whether he broke any new ground. And it's true that he repeated some of the stuff that was in the report. But what I argued today is that the very fact that he chose to emphasize those particular things in the particular political context of the moment was itself highly significant.
Right. Right. So, you know, there was a lot of conflicting information that he was only speaking with Barr's permission, that Barr had approved what he was going to say. But as I just played the second before I brought you on, if I had to take away one line from that statement that ran, 8 to 10 minutes or so, it was this.
If we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so.
If we had confidence the president did not commit a crime, we would have said so. I mean, that pretty much says it all. Obviously, there's a lot more, but that's the overlying statement here that the American public needs to take away, that Bill Barr has misrepresented for so long.
Well, that's true. And a form of that statement was in the report. But again, you know, for him to step forward and reiterate it right now is significant. Also, I think you need to look at that statement alongside his flat-out declaration that he was essentially forbidden from considering an indictment against the sitting president because of DOJ regulations. So he was saying, I couldn't consider indicting him for criminal obstruction of justice, but I didn't exonerate him. And let me be really clear, I didn't exonerate him because there was no way to exonerate him based on the fact.
Right, because I wasn't allowed to. And this is the thing that really surprises me. The Democrats have not done anything in regards to this, what is essentially a rule from the Office of Legal Counsel and the Department of Justice that says a sitting president can't be indicted. But that was written by some staffer back in the 70s. It's not codified in law. There's no law anywhere that says that. It's just a rule, a policy they're operating under that, as far as I can tell, nobody's challenged. Should somebody challenge that?
Yeah, well, I anticipate that at some point during the Democratic primaries, we'll have some kind of spirited debate along those lines. It's also worth saying that what you're pointing to there actually could be construed as a legitimate legislative purpose for what House Democrats are doing with their investigations. You'll recall that the White House has said all their document and subpoena requests and subpoenas are illegitimate because they don't actually have a real legislative purpose. Well, one legitimate legislative purpose would be to determine whether reforms are needed to be codified in law. And that's the type of thing that you could see codified in law, I think. I'm not an expert on that level of the legality of it. But generally speaking, House Democrats can argue that, look, there have been all kinds of abuses of power, and we need to determine whether some sort of new legislative safeguards need to be set in place. And that's why we need to conduct these investigations.
Absolutely. So then, Greg Sargent, what do you say? I mean, I'm looking at some of the Democratic response, and early on, you tweeted out something from Jamie Raskin, basically saying, okay, now it's time to, I'm paraphrasing here, shit or get off the pot. It's time to move on. We need to do something here. But coming from Nancy Pelosi, she's again, staying the course. Here's her quote. The Congress will continue to investigate and legislate to protect our elections and secure our democracy. What?
Yeah, I mean, it's just an extraordinary response to what was, again, a highly significant moment from the special counsel. They're really fumbling this. I mean, here was a chance to really grab onto an important public statement from Mueller and say something forceful and declarative about what's next. And all we got is just mealy-mouthed, non-committal, essentially, claptrap.
Right. So Nancy Pelosi, I mean, look, this is history repeating itself, too, because I'm old enough to remember back in 2006, before she took the speaker's gavel, her saying impeachment's off the table. Well, the table hadn't even been set yet, and she already took impeachment off the table. And it's like, it's here we go again. What will it take for this woman to understand that it is her responsibility as Speaker of the House to hold this president accountable? And the only way to do it, and the way that Robert Mueller, to my ears today, said to move forward was via the avenue that's available to them, and that's impeachment via Congress.
Well, I guess one way to think about what Pelosi's doing, and this would be the charitable way to think about it, is that she probably feels constrained, at least to some degree, by what her caucus members are telling her. And I don't have any doubt that members from who won really close races in very moderate districts in tough parts of the country, or even in districts that Trump carried, are saying that they don't want to do this. And, you know, that's her job, is to try to figure out how to balance all these different competing imperatives, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I would think that if this continues, and particularly if they lose a few in court in their oversight battles, that would start to turn the sentiment among even some of the more moderate members. And at some point, if they, you know, I should also say, if they actually start to win more in court, like they won a couple last week,
mm-hmm,
on getting access to Trump's finances through outside entities, if they start to win some more like that, you could see the pressure diminish for an impeachment inquiry. So I think a lot turns on how those oversight battles go.
Right. And again, well, now, obviously, Trump is appealing those couple of cases that he lost, and they'll likely go all the way to the Supreme Court. So who knows when we'll get a ruling on them. But Greg Sargent, before Mueller ever took to the stage this morning, you wrote your morning column at the Plumline blog, and in posting it on Twitter, you wrote this. You said, it's not clear Dems recognize the deep dangers of this moment. They appear unprepared for a possibility that Barr could soon give Trump's full saturation propaganda a big boost. Impeachment inquiry might be only weapon against that imbalance. And we learned that Barr is planning on some major news interview in the very near future. What are you alluding to here? What do you think Barr is going to do now?
Well, I guess it's he's telegraphed pretty clearly that he's running an investigation into the genesis of the investigation itself.
Right. The oranges.
And
yes.
Sorry. Right. And we've already seen the degree to which he's willing to spin and lie on behalf of the president to essentially mislead the country about what law enforcement's investigation actually entailed. And I don't see any reason not to assume that worse could be coming from him. I don't know that that'll happen, but it sure looks possible. And so if that investigation of the investigators miraculously turns up some sort of spun out, hyped evidence, in quotes, of misconduct in handling the investigation at the outset, then of course that'll be a big plus for Trump to spin his way. And what I argue in my piece this morning is that in an environment which is really rendered deeply imbalanced by the fact that one side is just willing to engage in full saturation propaganda like this, you know, to essentially blot out any hope of shared agreement on the facts, when one side's doing that, you're going to have a pretty powerful and well-built-up narrative of your own to counter it. And all these different piecemeal investigations going off in different directions with one court battle after another stretching out over months, I don't know if it is up to the task. Whereas an impeachment inquiry might be, right? Because it would be really squarely framed around the idea of the question of whether Trump is fundamentally has rendered himself unfit for office through corruption and misconduct.
Right.
So that's really, you know, I think we'll have to see how a lot of this stuff plays out. But I'm kind of hoping that Democrats come to understand that they really need to be incredibly forceful and clear in what they stand for in the propaganda wars that are coming.
And that's exactly what it is, though. It's the propaganda wars, because we all heard loudly and clearly today from his own mouth, Robert Mueller, saying we couldn't, if we had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so. Here's the statement from Sarah Sanders, the official press secretary of the president. Quote, "The special counsel has completed the investigation, closed his office, and has closed the case. Mr. Mueller explicitly said that he has nothing to add beyond the report and therefore does not plan to testify before Congress. The report was clear. There was no collusion, no conspiracy, and the Department of Justice confirmed there was no obstruction." That's not true. She continues, "Special Counsel Mueller also stated that Attorney General Barr acted in good faith in his handling of the report. After 2 years, the special counsel is moving on with his life and everyone else should do the same." That's the official
White House statement. That's just pure propagandistic reading of what happened.
Yeah. And so they're going to keep gaslighting the country. Right. So Greg Sargent, your book, An Uncivil War, came out a couple of months ago. And it really, it asks the question of how far our democracy has been injured, has been hurt, has been unhinged, if you will. How much have things changed? How much worse has it gotten, maybe I should ask, since the book was published?
Well, I published it, we published it last October.
Huh.
And I don't think, you know, there were some things that didn't happen that might have. Trump didn't end up removing Mueller,
right?
Although he did try, we've learned. And he took special steps that we've only just recently learned about to close down the investigation and so forth.
Yep.
So in certain respects, the worst hasn't quite happened. But in other respects, the disinformation wars have gotten a lot worse. The Barr's willingness to really function almost as little more than a propagandist for the president has really, I think, pushed this along to a point that very few of us could have anticipated. And, you know, I think you highlight an important thing when you read from that statement. They're all reading from the same set of propagandistic talking points. And it's really important to understand it not just as conventional political lying, but really more as disinformation, an effort to really blot out any possibility of shared agreement on facts. And it's really hard to say where this goes. If anyone has spent some time on Twitter or reading through articles about Trump voters, will come away understanding just how deeply misled millions and millions of people in this country really are by this propaganda machine.
Yes.
And, you know, I mean, we've seen it in the past in one way or another, but this just strikes me as something really fundamentally different and a lot worse than what we've seen before.
Right. I call it opposite world, but really it's the gaslighting of America. We have this administration and the Republican Party, which is even more insane when you think about it, issuing false statements, telling us essentially that the sky is green, and if you don't believe it, then you're the crazy one, and doubling and tripling down on it. And I saw an interview with some woman on the news this morning who was a Fox viewer. That's where she got her news from. And after hearing the Mueller statement, her response was, "I had no idea that the president had done anything wrong. Based on what I've heard about the Mueller report, I thought he was completely cleared." So there's this disinformation propaganda campaign going on, and it's being echoed not only by the White House, but by the Republican Party and a big part of the media that we could call state TV. We're in a really precarious situation here, and I see, you know, judging from Twitter anyway, and obviously my Twitter feed is probably skewed to the left, but the calls are pretty loud and clear that most, I think, Democrats, at least people who think like me, want the Democrats to open an impeachment inquiry, at least get the process started. But it seems like Nancy Pelosi is the brick wall. Now, Gerald Nadler spoke a few days ago. He sounded a lot more willing to go that route than he did today, unless I read him wrong.
Yeah, I think there was I think there is some movement on the Judiciary Committee. I spoke to Raskin, who's on the committee also today, and what he said is that you know you've got a majority of people on the committee, at least among Democrats, who really are pretty interested in doing this, and the sentiment is growing. So I think the Judiciary Committee members are in a bit of a different place, and Nadler heads that committee. Obviously, they're really steeped in the minutiae of the Mueller report and in minutiae about obstruction of justice and so forth and so on. So I think you saw Nadler drifting towards doing something precisely because he must know that really it's more than merited on the substance. And so maybe Pelosi told him, look, just give it another few weeks and let's see what happens. But I think the Judiciary Committee members are much closer. And one thing that's interesting, by the way, is that Judiciary members like Representative Raskin are trying to educate other members who aren't on the committee to get them to understand that an impeachment inquiry isn't the same as actual vote on impeachment articles.
Right.
And so it seems to me that one thing that could be holding things up is that there's just maybe a lot of members that don't quite understand what it would mean to launch an inquiry. So hopefully that could shift sentiment over coming days, too.
Definitely. Maybe that's a guest idea. I need to find somebody who can explain exactly how the process of impeachment works, because it seems like there's a lot of confusion about that. Anyway, Greg Sargent, thank you so much for jumping on the line with us today. It's obviously a busy, crazy news day. Read Greg Sargent. I do every morning at the Plumline blog at the Washington Post. He follow him on Twitter at @ThePlumlineGS for Greg Sargent. And of course, check out his new book, An Uncivil War: Taking Back Our Democracy in an Age of Trumpian Disinformation and Thunderdome Politics. And we need it right now. Greg Sargent, thank you so much. It's great to talk with you. I really appreciate it. Okay,
thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye. All right, coming up in a little while, we're going to speak with somebody else who's actually very, very active on Twitter. This guy's got almost 500,000 Twitter followers. I had never really communicated with him. His name is Scott Dworkin. His Twitter handle is @Funder. But he's got a series of books out about all the, I don't know if it's all the candidates. We'll have to ask him about many of the candidates on the Democratic side vying to unseat Donald Trump. It's the Meet the Candidates 2020, A Voter's Guide. I have the Elizabeth Warren edition in my hand. We'll find out from Scott in a few minutes if he did one for all 23 or 24. Like, is there one for Mike Gravel? Because I'd actually like the Mike Gravel book. Anyway, what I did, I've had a crazy busy day today. I had a voiceover session. I had a conference call for a progressive media new infrastructure that a few of us are trying to build. It's just, you know, lofty ideals, but it's, you know, desperate times call for desperate actions. Anyway, so I didn't have time to watch the Nadler thing. I understand Nancy Pelosi just spoke a few minutes ago. But before we get Scott Dworkin on the line, I want to share with you a little bit more from Robert Mueller, because I know a lot of people didn't get the chance to hear it. So here's Robert Mueller explaining, in an explanation that doesn't work for me, why they couldn't charge Trump with a crime.
And as set forth in the report, after that investigation, if we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so.
We would have said so. Okay.
We did not, however, make a determination as to whether the president did commit a crime. The introduction to the volume 2 of our report explains that decision.
Yes.
It explains that under long-standing department policy, a president cannot be charged with a federal crime while he is in office.
It's not a law.
That is unconstitutional.
No, it isn't.
Even if the charge is kept under seal and hidden from public view,
it's not unconstitutional. It's not in the Constitution.
The special counsel's office is part of the Department of Justice, and by regulation, it was bound by that department policy.
Well, it needs to be changed.
Charging the president with a crime was therefore not an option we could consider.
Charging the president with the crime, therefore, was not an option we could move ahead with. He was prohibited from doing it by this ridiculous bullshit rule. And then he said this.
The department's written opinion explaining the policy makes several important points that further informed our handling of the obstruction investigation.
Yeah.
Those points are summarized in our report, and I will describe two of them for you.
Okay.
First, the opinion explicitly permits the investigation of a sitting president because it is important to preserve evidence while memories are fresh.
Great. Investigation allowed.
Available.
Okay.
Among other things, that evidence could be used if there were co-conspirators.
There were.
Who could be charged now.
They should be.
And second, the opinion says that the Constitution requires a process other than the criminal justice system.
Yeah, impeachment.
To formally accuse a sitting president of wrongdoing.
Okay.
And beyond department policy, we were guided by principles of fairness. It would be unfair to potentially accuse somebody of a crime when there can be no court resolution of the actual charge.
I don't necessarily agree with that.
So that was Justice Department policy. Those were the principles under which we operated. And from them, we concluded that we would not reach a determination one way or the other about whether the president committed
a crime. So from that, they determined that they're not going to make a determination. Again, going against everything that Fox and Sarah Sanders and Dump himself are telling you. He was not cleared of anything. There was no exoneration because they couldn't find him. They couldn't charge him with a crime. So therefore, guess what? They couldn't clear him of one either. One last comment from Mueller. And boy, it's so weird hearing his voice because that's not the voice I imagined in my head just saying.
The indictments allege, and the other activities in our report describe, efforts to interfere in our political system.
Yes.
They needed to be investigated and understood.
Yes.
And that is among the reasons why the Department of Justice established our office.
Okay. So do your job.
That is also a reason we investigated efforts to obstruct the investigation.
As you should.
The matters we investigated were of paramount importance.
Yeah.
It was critical for us to obtain full and accurate information from every person we questioned.
Yeah.
When a subject of an investigation obstructs that investigation or lies to investigators,
as Trump did repeatedly,
it strikes at the core of their government's effort to find the truth hold wrongdoers accountable.
So do it. So hold him accountable. You just described what the president did. He obstructed your actions and he tried to cover up what you found. He lied about your findings. Why isn't he being held accountable? At the very least, Bill Barr should be held accountable for lying to the American people. I don't know what's so difficult. So today, I told you last week, maybe yesterday, that I tried calling my congressman. Or it was Thursday when I was talking to Howie Klein. My congressman is Ted Deutsch. He's a slightly left of center Democrat. He's okay. He's not great. He's not a progressive, but he's not a blue dog or a new Dem either. He just prevaricates. He's a fence sitter. And last week, I tweeted out something in response to him, to Ted Deutsch. I said, please get on board with initiating an impeachment inquiry. And I criticized him for not being on board. And his account, I don't know if it was him or a staffer, direct messaged me. and said and sent me the link to an interview he did on CNN where he sat on the fence. He basically said, yeah, we need to investigate more, but I don't know about impeachment yet. Let's just stay the course, you know, doing the Nancy Pelosi line. And so I called his office and invited him on the show to explain where what he thinks. And, of course, scheduling problems. He wasn't available any day last week. And then, of course, the House is on recess this week. And so he was unavailable this week, too. Obviously, they were putting me off because he doesn't want to answer the question. We all need to get on record today. Call your representatives. And I'm talking about your House member, not your two senators. They're coming, but later. They have nothing to do with this part of it. It's the House that has to open an impeachment inquiry. And they need to hear from us. So get on the phone and call them today. 224, I want to say 1231. Or call congress.org, I believe, is Tom Hartman's thing. That'll give you the phone numbers to the Capitol. Call your member of Congress and tell them to open an impeachment inquiry, period. All right. I mentioned we had this other guest booked. So, we're going to continue the discussion because I know that Scott Dworkin, who is, yes, very busy on Twitter, was quite busy this morning tweeting, calling for the impeachment of Donald Trump, calling for Nancy Pelosi to get off her bum and do the right thing. So at Funder is Scott Dworkin's Twitter handle. And a little bit after Mueller spoke, Scott tweeted, Mueller clearly stated five things today. One, Trump committed numerous crimes. Two, Trump's team conspired with Russia. Three, Trump obstructed justice. Four, Trump shouldn't be indicted. And five, four, Trump should be indicted. And five, Trump shouldn't be president. I agree with all that. So let's say hello to Scott Dworkin. Hey, Scott, welcome to the show.
Hey, what's shaking? How are you?
I'm hanging in there, which I think is the best any of us can say, which is better than I was, say, a year ago at this time when I was in full meltdown mode. I really think the election of Donald Trump, well, I know, took a real toll on my health. I'm finally clawing back out of the hole that I was thrown into and just not believing with each passing day what's happening in this country. Now, we're just meeting, but I've been following you online, and I know you're doing your best to keep this guy out of our lives. Unfortunately, it's not as easy as it should have been, is it?
No, it's not. He makes it really easy for us to, you know, list off reasons why he should be removed from office. And it's kind of like he's baiting us, but at the same time, now the time, what Mueller did today was say, stop tiptoeing around it, stop slow walking it, and, you know, move into the impeachment phase of things. And I ran the first impeachment campaign against him. And I think I did that. We started it the second he was sworn in, literally. And, cool. And I can tell you, you know, I'm going to be on the Hill next week, meeting with different members of Congress, making sure that, you know, Democrats are on the same page that he needs to be removed from office. And there needs to be a strategy in place of how to do that.
Right.
And I think,
which we don't have now.
It's going to be the route.
Right. We don't have that strategy right now because Nancy Pelosi is singing the same song she was singing, you know, a dozen years ago, saying impeachment's off the table before she even got a seat at the table. She said it. I want to back up a second and give you a proper introduction because I just brought you into the, you know, the monologue I was holding. Scott Dworkin is our guest. You're co-founder of the Democratic Coalition, a group you formed in 2016 with the main goal of making sure Trump never became president. It now exists to hold the White House accountable and to keep him from being reelected. So tell us about the Democratic Coalition. It's a PAC? It raises money?
Sure. We're a super PAC that is focused on online organizing. We're basically the biggest online organizers for the Democratic Party. And we focus on both individuals that are Republicans, digging up opposition research against Trump and others. And we obviously focused a lot on the Russia scandal and moving the ball in regards to, you know, getting a Mueller appointed, also in pushing for Flynn fired, and then also for, you know, legal actions and also short reports that get, you know, press, like reporting Flynn to the FARA, and that's what he eventually lied about. Anyway, so we focus on organizing Democrats and turning online activism into in-person action. And so that's what we're focused on for this cycle. And we'll be targeting, right now we're targeting 8 different senatorial races, and we'll be supporting 45 House races. And then whoever becomes the nominee will be supporting.
Awesome. Now, I noticed that today you tweeted out your support for, and I want to get his name right because I lost it, the new challenger to Lindsey Graham, Jamie Harrison. And I tweeted out my support for him. He immediately followed me. I direct messaged him and invited him on the show, and hopefully we'll get him on the show one day this week. This is the kind of stuff that we need to be doing. We need to be actively not only finding the best progressive candidates to take on some of these entrenched Republicans, but what we've learned, especially in this session of Congress with the Democrats controlling the House, that unless the Democrats also control the Senate, we're still screwed. Mitch McConnell is crowing about if another Supreme Court seat comes open in 2020, he'll name a new Supreme Court justice. Notice he said he'll name him, not Trump will. He'll confirm him. Mitch McConnell is a bit full of himself, but you know, this after their grandstanding during, you know, when Merrick Garland should have been confirmed to the court. We need to do everything we can to get these people out of power and take back control of democracy. So is Twitter your main organizing tool? Because I noticed you're close to 500,000 Twitter followers.
We use a combination of Twitter. We've pulled back on Facebook for obvious reasons, you know, lately. But we use that. And then I also, you know, we'll go on TV and radio and submit reports to Congress. But our main medium of distribution is Twitter. We figured that the best way to fight Trump was on his main propaganda outlet that he uses, which would be Twitter. Mm-hmm. And so making sure that we fight him on his own battlefield. And then, you know, I think it gets rid of one of the problems, or at least evens the playing field on that, because we were not prepared in 2016. We thought we were, but we were not prepared for the onslaught of fake online organizing that he did with Russia. And so I think we are prepared now as Americans in the resistance, but we are still, you know, obviously it was made clear and reaffirmed today by Mueller that the Trump campaign did, in fact, conspire with Russia. It just was not broad enough of a conspiracy of what they found. And that combined with the obstruction stuff, I mean, this is all going to roll into 2020, obviously. But we've got a big headache on our hands. And we do need to, you know, we need to make sure that when impeachment is presented, that it's the most effective impeachment as possible. It's not just something we vote on and then Senate kills it and then they bury it, you know, with the Mueller report. I think we got to be strategic about it. But, you know, that involves, obviously, as you said, making a strategy and then making that known to the public so that they know that there's a route here.
Right. And it starts, of course, with the impeachment inquiry. I think back, and again, I'm barely old enough to remember, but I was around during the Watergate years. We had Elizabeth Holtzman on the show on Friday, and she sat on the Judiciary Committee, and she voted for 3 articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon. And at the time, his approval ratings were pretty high. They were much higher than Trump's are today. But once hearings started on television and the American public was transfixed and saw the truth unfold on their TV screens, his approval ratings started plummeting. And he eventually, rather than being subject to an impeachment hearing, he resigned. I have no reason. I don't think Trump will resign easily, but I do believe that if the people are, you know, get to see hearings 24/7 that exposed the truths that are in the Mueller report, but nobody bothered to read, then the public opinion will change as well. I just don't know how we get past Nancy Pelosi.
I think we with the impeachment hearings, we need people that are not just Trump team people. That is one of the key points of that, is to have people that used to be affiliated with Trump testifying publicly, mm-hmm. people, and making sure that they're actually grilled with true questions. And we have to represent our entire case to the American people. Like, that's what's got to be done here. And it's got to be done methodically and clearly. And I think Mueller has given us all of the ammunition to do that, everything that we possibly could need, whether it's sound bites and everything else. But he should obviously also be forced to testify publicly in front of Congress as well.
I agree, but
which he'll be willing to do.
Who's going to shepherd this through the House? Because it needs a leader. It needs somebody to take charge. Should be the Speaker of the House, which I think we'd be much better served with a Maxine Waters, because she's been calling for impeachment for a long time now. What do we do about Pelosi? How do we convince her, or can we convince her?
I don't think that I think she supports, obviously, Trump not being in office, probably
right.
his resignation and everything else. I think that, there's got to be someone who pauses. And I think that's what she's trying to do. I don't know exactly what they're trying to stall for or, right now, obviously, this week, nothing would happen because they're not in session. But
right.
when they come back next week,
mm-hmm.
there's not really that many other reasons to not. And so I would say that, the edging into it because of public scrutiny and public pressure, which we'll have to keep up. I think that she'll eventually turn the corner and say, what we're doing here now, what we're doing with these hearings is the beginnings of an impeachment inquiry, but we need to make it official.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll try to slow walk it over to the next thing, because, again, their fear is if we get an impeachment vote and then it goes away, it's just not an effective impeachment. And the goal, again, is not just to slap them on the wrist and then move on. The goal is to actually force his removal from office,
sure.
whether resignation.
Right.
Or through impeachment.
Right. And as far as, the Senate, we know what the makeup of the Senate is. I think our leverage lies in the American people hearing every word from every witness, because,
absolutely.
You know, there's nothing redacted in an impeachment hearing. It's all out in the open. So, Scott Dworkin,
right.
I also want to ask you about these books. You've got a series of books, Meet the Candidates 2020, A Voter's Guide, and I'm holding in my hand the Elizabeth Warren edition. Did you do one of these for each of the Democratic candidates?
Yeah, as of right now, we've focused on the federal candidates plus Pete and Biden, and we'll be expanding from there depending on how the debates play out for a lot of these folks, but we are writing them currently as we go. We're on book number 6 right now, and we'll keep on writing them as long as there are candidates in the field,
because uh-huh.
I think it's important for us to, we have to know the full biography and everything that someone stands for,
mm-hmm.
and have an honest take in the background that, has someone who's worked with these people in the past, but also can present an argument of why they could possibly win and what their route would be to win. And so people can analyze that, and we don't get stuck in a situation like we were not knowing everything about Donald Trump.
Sure.
We don't want that ever to happen again. And so we want people to just be educated as much as possible on the candidates. And so that's why we started producing this series.
I think it's a great idea, and I love that you do it, and they're handy little books. But here's my constructive criticism question, is why didn't you do this online? I mean, because for a book, obviously, somebody's got to purchase each edition. If they were online, I always thought the perfect idea for our campaign financing problems was to level the playing field. And every candidate, let's just talk about the presidency. This is my pie in the sky campaign finance idea. Each candidate gets a website, and they're all sort of, there's a format to them. So they're all basically the same thing where the candidate fills in all their information. So one isn't flashier than the others, but it's a place, a clearinghouse for information about the candidates, where they stand on every topic. You know, they have to answer a series of questions and fill out the entire questionnaire on the website so the American people can compare apples to apples. And then there would be a cable channel that's available on every cable system, on every satellite, TV satellite system, and as a standalone streaming website where each candidate gets a 10-minute block for their propaganda video. And they run constantly. Or you could play the candidates that you want to watch. I think we need to be able to compare apples to apples and get money out of politics. I know that sort of goes against your business model, but wouldn't that make sense?
Well, no, the goal from, the organization that we started in the first place was to be so annoying that they want to get rid of super PACs and money in politics.
Okay, I like that.
That was the goal, because we've only raised less than, it's like 900,000 over the period of 2.5 years. And so we represent 0.03% of all super PAC money raised in the 2018 cycle.
Uh-huh.
But we also are one of the more effective spenders. When it comes down to, you know, with races and how we can get PR and whatnot. I don't think that, I think first of all, we need to get rid of everything involving Citizens United, anything involving campaign finance, where we can reset to at least McCain-Feingold standards. But at the same time, we can't have, as I say in the Warren book, the first time that I met Warren, she did not talk to me about anything. Are you a consultant in DC? Like, you know, can you give me some money or anything like that? What she talked about was my t-shirt.
Uh-huh.
And that was kind of, it was like, what is she bringing up my t-shirt for? And it's because she's a real person that did not care about whether or not I was ever going to be financially supporting her campaign. And that is how people need to be able to operate. They need to be able to talk like AOC. They should never restrain themselves because of a donor, and
yes,
they should never hold back because of a donor,
yes,
because that is corruption, and we got to keep that out of politics. So money in politics from individuals with a very, very small limit, I think, would be really great, with nothing else, with no organizational support, mm-hmm, no corporations, no money like that. Especially no money that's dark money, you know, where they set up an organization, magically $30 million gets spent in the state via, mm-hmm, some America Thrives organization, which is basically propaganda for the Republicans. And so we got to make sure that we reset what the rules are, because we can't, as a person who fundraised for over a decade in D.C., I can tell you, like, a lot of politicians will base their decisions on who's going to give them money or not give them money,
right,
because that's what they have to do to keep their job. And we can't have a Washington like that.
No, not at all. So let me ask you this, because going back through your history, Scott Dworkin is our guest. You find him on Twitter at Funder, and he's the co-founder of the Democratic Coalition. They're at democraticcoalition.org, and they've got a great series of books out on the 2020 Democratic candidates. It's Meet the Candidates 2020, A Voter's Guide. Back in 2016, your bio says that you both were part of the Run Warren Run movement. I still have some of you know, the draft Warren paraphernalia here from Netroots Nation that year, and also part of the coalition trying to draft Joe Biden. I can't think of two more disparate candidates, unless we put Bernie Sanders in the mix against Joe Biden. Do you support somebody based on their policies, or are you just like vote blue no matter who?
I mean, I'm definitely a vote blue no matter who. But when it came to those candidates, I started with Warren.
Uh-huh.
And I think that was in 2015,
right,
where we tried to recruit her to run. Then we moved into Biden in the fall, and he ultimately obviously decided not to run. You know, the transition between the two was definitely awkward, because it just is a completely different candidate. And at that point, you know, I saw the infighting between what I saw from the outside of Bernie and Hillary. And I was very concerned that, you know, we need something to stabilize this, or So I was thinking big picture, and I also thought that Donald had a potential chance of actually winning.
Yeah, against Hillary, he did.
So in that fear, I looked for who can win the general, and so that's what I kind of bought into there. But I also, you know, off and on for 9 years, I had the opportunity to be able to work with Biden and Sanders and Warren and you know, on down the list, and it's just in the broad scheme of things, they're all a lot better than the other side. And so I look at a mix of winnability, but they have to stand by what they stand for. They have to actually walk the way that they talk. They can't. I've never worked for people that I don't believe in.
Right.
And so, you know, that was the main goal, was to try and recruit somebody else outside of the mix to try and make a difference in regards to the presidential race. It obviously did not work. And I don't, you know, I don't, I'm not sure how much of a dent it actually made in either case. But, you know, it was helpful in developing what eventually became the Democratic coalition, because the idea was to, no matter what we're doing, no matter what we're thinking at a certain time, no matter if we have division in our party, we need to all stay on the same page overall.
Right.
And one way to do that is through the coalition, where we, at the overarching values that we stand for as Democrats, we all agree on a lot of those things, on most of those things. And so let's focus on what we can agree on. And then let's also focus on how we can target Republicans in regards to campaigning against them and exposing them for the frauds that they are.
Gotcha. But here's my dilemma, Scott. I am a progressive first. I don't hold party allegiance. I got really angry at the Democratic Party for the nonsense they pulled on Bernie Sanders in 2016, to the point where I would have left the party if not for the primaries, because I think the primaries is the most important vote we can cast. In fact, the only reason I registered as a Democrat here in Florida is so that I can vote in the primaries. Otherwise, I'd be independent. Not that I'd ever vote for a Republican. I don't appreciate the way the party does things. And my efforts to fight back against them haven't been very fruitful, honestly. So I look at this slate of candidates, and there's some good people there. There's also some people who shouldn't be there, and I think Joe Biden is at the top of the list. I see Joe Biden as Hillary Clinton 2.0. If he goes up against Donald Trump, the Democrats will lose again. I see it as clearly as I see the sky is blue, but this is also the world in which Trump tells us the sky is green, and a good enough number of the people in this nation believe him. So, we're running at a deficit here. I don't understand the Joe Biden thing. We were talking about raising money. He's not doing small dollar fundraisers. He's doing those big dollar meet and greets with the rich and the elite. The thing that Elizabeth Warren is eschewing this time. She says, I'm not doing those big money fundraisers. Instead, I'll talk to you. If you make a small dollar contribution to my campaign, I just may call you. We know Bernie doesn't take that kind of money. This is the do you see? I mean, do you have a favorite in this campaign?
No, and that's why we did the book series, because I'm not biased towards anybody. After being able to work with Obama, it kind of makes it hard to work immediately again for a great candidate, whoever it may be. I think that you'll see former Vice President Biden come out and, justify raising money because he doesn't want to cut off his arm or whatever, you know. He wants to play on an even playing field. I think what Warren is doing is great, because she pledged to just not do it overall. All of these decisions that people make now will be brought up in the debate, and they'll be exposed for what they are. And so, you know, these decisions have consequences. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why Warren probably chose to do that. Well, not only does she believe it, but also the fact that it is something that sets her apart from Biden.
Yes.
And then obviously Sanders doesn't go for that money. He doesn't hold those kind of events. So that also separates him.
Yeah,
doesn't
but
it?
We have Joe Biden sorry, but as you know, one who watches the news incessantly, unfortunately, I have to for my job, and follows what's going on, mm-hmm. Joe Biden is, in my book, no better than Trump in that he says one thing and does another. He talks about that he's the most progressive in the field. He's far from that. He talks about, you know, not taking money from fossil fuels. He's in bed with them. He talks about, you know, I could go on and on and on like this, but I don't want this to be the bash Joe Biden hour. My point is just that I believe he's an anachronism. He is not what 2020 calls for. His time has passed. And I think the reason he's so strong in the polls right now is because it's name recognition. There hasn't been a single debate yet. And I hope and I believe that once the debates happen and the American people see the other candidates and hear from them, that Joe Biden's numbers are going to start dropping like a rock.
You just like with, you know, anyone else who's paired themselves with a different candidate before where they've played the second in role, a lot of times they'll make that separation at some point. And I'm guessing that'll be the first debate where people stop associating Joe Biden directly with Obama.
Right.
And so there's a lot of, you see what I'm saying? Like there's going to be a lot of correlation between that because they'll see him speak in front of other people. He'll have to overcome different obstacles and he'll become Joe Biden, the candidate, not Obama's vice president.
Right. Right. And unfortunately, right now, the media, you know, they've got 24/7 to fill, sort of, because they repeat shows overnight and all that. But they've got a lot of airtime to fill. And what they keep going back to is the horse race. Yet none of them are talking about the fact that at this point in a presidential election, the polls are based on name recognition. Joe Biden is obviously the most well-known. Bernie Sanders is second because he was the, you know, he was the runner-up for the nomination 4 years ago. I wish the media would stop putting their fingers on the scale, which they just do constantly. We know, hey, you know, message to MSNBC. We get it. You're owned by Comcast and you really like Joe Biden. And for some reason, you like Mayor Pete, too. We got it. I long for the days when a newscast was objective. I long for Walter Cronkite and even Peter Jennings. You know, those are days gone by. Mm-hmm. But if we could get some objectivity in our reporting on these candidates, that might help a little bit. But we see these media companies owned by big corporations who have a horse in this race, putting their fingers on the scale. But most people who are watching those shows don't realize that they're being manipulated. It's another reason why I like my idea of everybody getting the same, campaign materials to work from.
Right. Yeah. No, and there's a lot of people that would agree with you in that fact. And I think that they have to do a better job at covering the story, not just what's breaking. They can't just look at, you know, what's the quickest next thing. Cause that's what got us. That's one of the reasons that we got us in this problem in the first place, which got us Trump in the first place, mm-hmm. is starting to buy into the right now instead of the overall picture. And I think it takes real journalism and real work and a return to that, is going to have to happen where, you know, we uncover big stories about Trump and we continue down that road. And if it's on other candidates that are Democrats running, like those need to be exposed as soon as possible. Yep. If there's any kind of scandals like that. And it's just going to go on and on with the breaking as long as the American people keep watching it. So I think at some point we're going to have to kind of cut back on the news intake. I call it, you know, the information diet. And that's
right. And
it's a good book.
It's the horse race attitude aspect of it. You know, if they were actually mm-hmm. reporting on policies, here's the latest policy Elizabeth Warren unveiled, that would actually be helpful. But instead, all they do is report on the polls. Ooh, Joe Biden's up and Bernie Sanders is down. Scott Dworkin, before we're running out of time, before we go, I got to ask you, you also, in addition to helping run democraticcoalition.org and managing your 475,000 Twitter followers, and writing these books, you also have a podcast, The Dworkin Report, yes?
Yeah. We're going into season 2, and we'll be interviewing some really cool resistors. And, you know, my goal from the show is just to put a spotlight on some people that deserve it, combined with talking to some interesting people who might be famous. So, you know, last season we talked to people like Alyssa Milano, Alec Baldwin, and others.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I enjoyed it, and I'm just going to keep on going down that path and see where it goes from there. But it's still an independent podcast, and we enjoy listeners in over 100 countries, and I'm looking forward to expanding it and providing a megaphone for the resistance.
Nice. Well, thank you for joining us today on the Nicole Sandler Show. I appreciate it. Scott Dworkin, again, of Democratic Coalition, or democraticcoalition.org, and follow him on Twitter at Funder. Scott, it was nice talking to you. Nice meeting you. And, go Bernie, go Elizabeth, go almost anybody but Trump.
Yeah, right on. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure. Take care. Bye-bye. All right. And that's it for today. Tomorrow on the program, it's Thursday. Howie Klein will be here. So we'll see you then. Keep your head up and call your congressman.
I read the news today. Oh, boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
The Supreme Court on Tuesday sort of punted when it came to Roe v. Wade. They decided to leave blocked a provision in Indiana law that says the state may prohibit abortions based on race, sex, or disability. But the court did allow another part of the law requiring clinics to bury or cremate fetal remains to take effect. This case did open a huge divide on the court on this topic, as dueling footnotes from Justices Clarence Thomas and Ruth Bader Ginsburg to the unsigned opinion show battle lines being drawn for future abortion cases. And other states continue cracking down on abortion access. On Friday, Missouri could become the first state since Roe v. Wade was decided in 1973 to no longer offer abortions. The state's health department is expected to block services at the last health center providing abortions beginning June 1st. Speaking of the Supreme Court, was Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. At a Paducah Chamber of Commerce luncheon in Kentucky on Tuesday, McConnell was asked by a member of the audience, should a Supreme Court justice die next year, what will your position be on filling that spot? He responded while smirking, I would fill it, a response that reportedly drew laughter from the crowd. Of course, McConnell infamously refused to consider President Obama's nomination of Merrick Garland in 2016, claiming that a president should not be able to name a judge to the Supreme Court during an election year. When confronted with the hypocrisy of that answer, McConnell's explanation changed, saying the decision not to consider Garland's nomination was because the Senate was held by a different party than the president leading into it. Quote, leader stated clearly that if Hillary Clinton, he, with the backing of his party, including people like John McCain, actually said they'd hold the seat open for the entire 4 years of her term.
I promise you that we will be united against any Supreme Court nominee that Hillary Clinton, if she were president, would put up.
Yeah, that's your reasonable John McCain for you. Meanwhile, there is a reasonable Republican. His name is Justin Amash. He's a congressman from Michigan, and he held a town hall meeting in Grand Rapids Tuesday evening where he received multiple standing ovations from a mostly friendly crowd. Amash was catapulted into the national spotlight last week when he tweeted a lengthy screed explaining that after a full reading of the Mueller report, it became apparent to him that Donald Trump must be impeached.
I'm confident that if you read Volume 2, you will be appalled at much of the conduct, and I was appalled by it, and that's why I stated what I stated. That's why I came to that conclusion, because I think we can't let conduct like that go unchecked. Congress has a duty to keep the president in check. We have a job to do, and I think we owe it to the American people to represent them, and that's why I took the position I did, and I would do it whether it was a Democratic president or a Republican president. It doesn't matter to me.
He ended the event that ran 2 hours instead of the one scheduled by letting on that others agree with him.
A lot of them think I'm right about the Mueller report, and they just won't say it. There are a lot of the Republicans. And what they'll say to me is, Justin, going out publicly with that, you know the Democrats will never support you. You know that they're hypocrites on this stuff. And I say, some of them are, some of them aren't, but it doesn't matter to me. Because you have to look at what you're doing first. And if you have a society where all we care about is that the other side is bad, and therefore we don't have to do the right thing, that society will break down and you will have no liberty. For those of you who care about liberty, who care about our Constitution, I assure you, the surest way to make our Constitution a dead letter is to have a society where we all hate each other and we don't care about what the other side is doing, what they're doing, right or wrong. We're just going to hate them and disagree with them. That's the surest way to destroy our Constitution. And I refuse to be a part of that. I will always stand up for liberty, stand up for our Constitution.
Amash went back to Twitter Tuesday to give his Trump treatment to Attorney General William Barr. James Comey is back with a new op-ed in the Washington Post in which he argues that we shouldn't ignore Trump's rants because, quote, millions of good people believe what a president of the United States says. But Comey focused on what he calls Trump's lies, quote, that the FBI was corrupt and committed treason, that they spied on the Trump campaign and tried to defeat him. He directly addressed the false narrative being echoed by Fox or state TV, writing, quote, there is a reason the non-fringe media doesn't spend much time on this, quote, treason and corruption business. The conspiracy theory makes no sense. But go ahead, investigate the investigators if you must. When those investigations are over, you will find the work was done appropriately and focused only on discerning the truth of very serious allegations. There was no corruption. There was no treason. There was no attempted coup. Those are lies, and dumb lies at that. The words of James Comey in his Washington Post op-ed. I got the good. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I really can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com/donate.